From social justice organizers.
The city of Madison is narrowing down its search for the new library director.
A Dane County board candidate outlines his campaign priorities.
And in the second half, a conversation on the arts and archives, some headlines from 63 years ago, and the most comprehensive weather report on the airwaves.
So stay tuned, all that and a lot more, but first we'll go live to London for some news around the world from the BBC.
Hello, I'm Temeskin Debesai with the BBC News. China has described a potential US ban on TikTok as an act of bullying that would backfire on America. The House of Representatives has overwhelmingly passed a bill that could force the app's Chinese owners to either sell up or be barred in the US. The vote increases tensions between Beijing and Washington over who controls technology that could affect national security and free speech. Nomia Iqbal in Washington has more details.
President Biden's administration has said if it passes the Senate, where it faces a difficult passage, he'll sign it into law. He's already stopped federal employees from having it on their staff phones, but his campaign team has started using the app to tap into young voters. And Donald Trump has flip-flopped. He had originally spearheaded the move to get it banned. TikTok has always denied it is passing American users' data to the Chinese government. TikTok has called it a ban and has told US senators to listen to their constituents before deciding how to vote.
Israel says it's looking into an apparent Israeli airstrike on a UN food distribution center in Rafah City. Five people were reportedly killed in the attack. The head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, Philip Lazzarini, said the strike was carried out despite the location of the center being given to Israeli forces on Monday. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, says a planned maritime route to deliver humanitarian aid to Gaza can't be a substitute for getting more aid in by land. Mr. Blinken said the US-led initiative to build a floating harbor off the Gaza coast could only complement what were currently insufficient efforts elsewhere.
When established, this corridor will enable the distribution of up to 2 million meals every single day, as well as medicine, water, and other critical humanitarian supplies. This is something that's going to take time to actually put in place. It is a complement to other ways of getting humanitarian assistance into Gaza, and in particular, overland routes remain the most critical way.
The far-right Dutch politician Geert Wilders has failed in his bid to become prime minister. His anti-Islam, anti-migrant freedom party won almost a quarter of the vote in the general election last November. But coalition talks have repeatedly broken down. Anna Holligan reports.
Mr. Wilders has accepted if he wants a right-wing government, he'll have to sacrifice his own political ambitions to lead it. At this stage, and after weeks of apparent deadlock, a partly technocratic cabinet with looser ties to political parties and no solid coalition agreement is looking like one of the most feasible scenarios. Mr. Wilders' announcement is not entirely surprising. It follows the conclusion of the latest round of talks among the four party leaders hoping to form a coalition government.
World News from the BBC. One of the main leaders vying for power in Haiti has rejected an agreement that led to the resignation of the Prime Minister Ariel Henry on Monday. Guy Philippe, who served a prison sentence in the US for drug trafficking, says he resents the fact that as a former convicted criminal, he won't be able to have a seat on the Transition Council that's due to be appointed by Thursday. One man has died and 29 people have been rescued after a gold mine collapsed in the Australian state of Victoria. Police and union officials said two men were pinned by fallen rocks hundreds of metres underground in the mine at Ballarat. One body has since been recovered. The other man was airlifted to hospital, having reportedly suffered life-threatening injuries. Scientists in Britain studying the menopause in some species of whales have discovered that, like humans, it leads to females having longer lifespan. This in turn helps them to support their offspring for longer. Helen Briggs has the story.
Killer whales are among the handful of species known to go through the menopause. By studying them, scientists hope to solve a biological puzzle. In evolutionary terms, stopping reproducing partway through your life doesn't make a great deal of sense, given the drive to pass on your genes. But researchers at the University of Exeter have discovered the five whale species that go through menopause have a longer lifespan. This suggests the menopause evolved to allow grandmother whales to help younger generations survive without producing more mouths to feed.
The Australian footballer Josh Cavallo, who's known as a trailblazer for gay men in the sport, has proposed to his boyfriend on the pitch at Adelaide United's Cooper Stadium. The midfielder came out in 2021 and at the time was the world's only top-flight openly gay male professional footballer. And that's the latest world news from the BBC.
Good evening, this is Rob McClure and Vicky Iden bringing you your local news live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in downtown Madison. Here are the headlines for this evening.
President Biden came through Wisconsin today, taking the opportunity to announce more than $3 billion for infrastructure projects, reports the Associated Press. The funding will head toward communities across the U.S., with an eye towards communities disrupted by the federal interstate system after World War II. And some of that money is headed to Milwaukee. As part of that campaign stop, the president announced $36 million to improve a 2.5-mile stretch of the city's South 6th Street. The White House says 6th Street was widened in the 1960s to accommodate more traffic, displacing surrounding neighborhoods that are predominantly black and brown. The White House adds in a statement that the construction of the interstate system in Milwaukee led to the demolition of roughly 17,000 homes and 1,000 businesses.
The state Senate wrapped up its legislative session yesterday. We mentioned in brief on last night's show that the Senate approved a transgender athlete ban that the governor has promised to veto, as well as a bill mandating education in Asian American and Hmong history. But the Senate also advanced several constitutional amendments, which require multiple legislative sessions to be approved and, of course, to be put to voters. One of those amendments will appear on the ballot this August. It asks voters to approve a measure curtailing the governor's ability to spend federal funds without seeking legislative approval. Two other constitutional amendments could appear before voters in future years if approved again by the state legislature next session. One would bar the use of partial vetoes that lead to an increase in taxes or fees, and another would require state hiring decisions to be made on the basis of, quote, merit, fairness, and equality. Other last-minute bills approved by the Senate yesterday? One requires that political campaign ads disclose any use of AI in those ads. Another allows the Department of Justice's Office of School Safety to stay open for another 2 years. And another would make it a Class A felony to picket or demonstrate in front of a judge's home if, quote, the intention is to interfere, obstruct, or impede the administration of justice. Notably, the state Senate declined to advance a bill that would allow election clerks some breathing room in counting ballots. A bill that would have allowed clerks to start tallying ballots a day early did not proceed.
State lawmakers yesterday also moved to make it easier to request federal money for electric vehicle chargers. That bill now heads to Governor Evers. Wisconsin is behind other states in both how many EVs are on the road and how many EV chargers are available in the state, reports the Capital Times. One reason for the lack of charging stations is a state regulation which limits the sale of electricity by the kilowatt hour to public utilities. The state would need to allow retail businesses to sell electricity in this way if it wants to access some of the $78 million available in federal money to build EV charging stations. Wisconsin and Nebraska are the only two states to not allow private businesses to sell electricity. The current bill brought to Evers would help change that. Last month, the legislature passed another bill that would allow the state to set up an EV infrastructure program, which opens the door to get federal funding for the program. Allowing private companies to sell electricity would clear the path entirely for Wisconsin to fund that program with the help of federal dollars. Evers is expected to sign both bills into law.
An easy winter might make for a tougher wildfire fighting season, according to a recent report from the National Interagency Fire Center. And Wisconsin's wildfire season has started early this year. There have been twice as many wildfires this year as compared to the average of the same period over the last 10 years. And that may continue this month and next, thanks to a warm, dry winter delivering much less snow than normal. That increases the potential for fires to start.
Four school districts in Dane County will have funding referendums on the ballot this spring, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. Stoughton School District will ask voters to approve an additional $6.1 million for operations. This is a $4 million increase in the first year and an additional $600,000 in each of the next 3 years. McFarland is requesting an increase of over $10 million over the next 3 years, with each year increasing the budget approximately $3.7 million. Wisconsin Heights School is requesting an increase of $12.6 million over the next 4 years, or $3.2 million each year. And the Marshall School District is requesting $5 million in capital improvement funds for major repairs of the elementary school and improvements in the athletic facilities.
And the spring election is less than 3 weeks away now. You can check what's on your specific ballot at My Vote Wisconsin at myvote.wi.gov. You can also check to make sure you're registered to vote. Today is the final day for online or mail registration. Anyone who has moved, even if it's just to a new apartment in the same building, needs to update their voter registration. But you still have time to register in person if you're planning to vote absentee in person. And you can register at the polls on Election Day on April 2nd. And those were the headlines. Now on to the rest of the day's top stories.
This morning, the county officially broke ground on the new Dane County Jail. The ceremony wasn't open to the public, but that didn't stop protesters from voicing their opposition to the project. WORT News producer Faye Parks was there.
This morning's groundbreaking ceremony was held in the parking lot behind the current county jail. About 40 people were in attendance, including law enforcement officers, county board supervisors, NAACP Dane County leadership, healthcare contractors, and members of the project's design team. Also in attendance, though set back from the rest of the crowd, about 10 protesters with Freedom Inc., a local nonprofit that works with low to no-income communities of color. They chanted their opposition throughout the ceremony, calling for alternatives to incarceration. Dane County Sheriff Calvin Barrett opened today's proceedings by describing the new jail's difficult path to construction. The project has seen strong opposition and a lack of funding since its conception 20 years ago.
It took a lot of hard work. It took a lot of research. It took a lot of time, meetings, and discussions to get us where we are here right now.
Last April, the county board approved the funds for a new public safety building. The six-story, 825-bed tower will consolidate the aging current jail and the Ferris Work Release Center on the south side. But those plans hit another roadblock last fall when the sole bid from Myron Construction came in almost $28 million over budget. After some hand-wringing, the county board approved those additional funds in late January. The project's budget now totals $207 million. David Way led the design team at Mead & Hunt. He says the jail's final plans are slightly scaled down, but will still address the county's needs.
This building will accomplish the mission of providing a safe, secure, and humane environment for those individuals committed to the custody of the sheriff for fair treatment, respect, and dignity.
And according to Sheriff Barrett, the new facility will have the capacity to better serve the folks incarcerated there.
We now have, will have in 2.5 years, medical and mental health beds for our residents. We will have programming space, and we will eliminate long waiting lists for those that are waiting to get into our fantastic programming at our Dane County Jail. We will greatly reduce solitary confinement. We will have one consolidated facility, and more importantly, we will close the old and outdated city county building.
But he also said that the jail is not a magic wand that can address the myriad issues facing the county.
What it is a piece to the societal puzzle that we call criminal justice reform. And it will take all community caretakers, all community stakeholders to get to the root causes of the issues that we see in our communities that lead to incarceration.
Greg Jones, president of NAACP Dane County, spoke today in support of the new jail. He says it will more safely house its residents.
Civil rights follow us no matter where we go. Individuals who are housed or confined in this facility have civil rights. We want to ensure as best we can, as long as we can, as strong as we can, that their rights are observed, protected, and meaningful.
Meanwhile, protesters with Freedom Inc. took issue with the millions of public dollars poured into incarceration.
Why is this the biggest project in county history?
Budgets are a moral document. You all are showing that you are morally bankrupt.
That was Monka Donway, the co-executive director of Freedom Inc. Donway went on to argue that there are more effective ways of spending the county's money.
Everyone is scared right now. Those people in there are scared. The economy is crumbling. There's no housing. There's no access to quality food. And your answer is to lock them up? They got families just like you.
And Donway continued to address Sheriff Barrett and the other county officials, even after their speeches came to a close.
And Calvin, this is to you. It's a shame that you're standing there helping facilitate this right now. It is a shame. You say you're coming for our people. You're coming to support our people. All I see you doing is helping in their downfall.
The jail consolidation project is expected to be completed in 2026.
Next, I would like to call up Jonathan Cooper, who is the chair of the Bassett Neighborhood Organization, which will be our partner for the future moving forward with this new facility.
Reporting for WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
There are three finalists in the nationwide search for Madison's next library director. On Saturday, the public was invited to Goodman Library to meet the candidates, and our reporter David Ahrens took up the offer.
The city has been looking for a new library director and has identified three finalists. In an effort to keep the community involved in the search, Madison's Library Board hosted a get-together last Saturday. About 50 people showed up to mingle, and I had the opportunity to speak with each of the finalists. Tana Elias has been with the Madison Public Library for over 30 years. She started as a page and is now the Director of Community Outreach and Marketing. And she's proud of the work she's accomplished over that time.
Strategic planning and rebranding and the Wisconsin Book Festival and the Bubbler and all of those kind of innovative programs.
Tana says that libraries are a vital resource for the community, and that became especially clear during the pandemic.
We help people navigate divorce and job loss. We help people learn how to cook different foods. We help people learn how to help their children learn to read. There are so many ways that people use library resources. They use our collections, they use our technology, they use our spaces, they come to our programs. You know, I think we're one of the one safe, free places where people can connect, and people can connect across ages and cultures, and that's vitally important.
The second candidate is Peter Petruski. He's the chief operating officer for the Arlington, Virginia library system, which is comparable in size to Madison's own system.
I view public libraries as connectors and as equalizers and levelers, where you can bring everyone from the community to one place to help them get resources, not only public library resources like leisure reading and, you know, story times and that sort of thing, but also vaccine clinics, tax help, voting, like all these really critical things to our functioning society.
Peter says he admires the Madison community's connection to their libraries.
There's always people in the library really enjoying it, whether it's, you know, kids who are frolicking and rampaging around the children's section, to people who are reading, or I've seen tutoring in the study rooms.
The third candidate, Sarah Townsend, is currently the assistant director of Suffolk Library in Virginia. The system has three libraries. Townsend told me that she's pleased with the Madison Library staff she's met so far.
Customer service I'm seeing at the desk, the relationships that they clearly have with the patrons that come in, And as a potential new director, those are things that I'm looking at because that tells you a lot about the team culture.
Townsend also explained that she's accustomed to budget challenges in the face of reduced revenue.
But a lot of the behind-the-scenes work is really building advocacy partners in our community that can have the conversations with elected officials that we can't necessarily as city employees.
Anita Weir, an advocate for the Lakeview Library, was also at Goodman on Saturday. She says that the new library director should have a broader perspective.
I'd like the director to pay attention to all the areas of town, not just the central library or the rich areas, because north and south are both a little not so rich and need library services.
Before leaving, I asked an anonymous employee what qualities she's looking for in the new library director.
Right now is a very delicate time financially in the city of Madison, and we really need someone who has the vision to place the library in a way that we are able to sort of move forward and grow as the community is asking us to grow, but also to support all of the needs of the city of Madison.
The search for the next library director comes after the retirement of Greg Michaels, who retired in February after 11 years. Reporting for WORT News, I'm David Ahrens.
In less than 3 weeks, Dane County voters will decide who sits on the county board. The District 9 seat represents Madison's far west side. There are two candidates in that race, incumbent supervisor Stephen Peters and challenger John Wallinger. The two of them will face off on April 2nd. Earlier today, Supervisor Peters spoke to WORT news producer Faye Parks to discuss his priorities for District 9.
Thank you for joining me, Stephen.
Happy to be here.
So to start, can you tell us a bit about yourself? What is your background and what are some of your accomplishments since being elected to the county board?
A little bit about myself. I first came down to Madison and Dane County, like so many folks do, 20 years ago to go to UW. I met my fiance here and we've made our home on the west side for pushing 12 years now. I really fallen in love with Madison and Dane County. Now I've lived here longer than I've lived anywhere else. So it really is truly home to me. It was a Dane County Board Supervisor from 2018 to 2022, at what point redistricting happened and got put in with my dear friend now, State Representative Alex Jors, and so I decided not to run again. And then over the summer, he stepped down, and so I was reappointed to the board. So in my time I've been back on the board, I got back in time just in time to participate in the budget process. And I think one of my biggest and most favorite accomplishments that we've gotten done just in this last 6 months is the authorization for the increased funds for the Dane County Housing Development Fund. I've been amazed and shocked by how successful that program has been and the work it's doing to help work with developers who want to create projects in our community to boost those affordable units and make sure that we're doing all we can to address the housing crisis in Dane County.
And do you have any priorities specifically for District 9?
So the trick with District 9 is we're a very residential district, but that doesn't mean that we're kind of monolithic, kind of sandwiched between two very established neighborhoods of Hawks Landing and Black Hawk. There's a vast middle where a huge amount of development is taking place, and so we're a fast-growing, rapidly changing district with a lot of young families moving in. And because of that, we need better connections to the rest of Dane County and the city in particular, where we can actually get services and get access to groceries and get that kind of stuff available to us. Something I really want to work on is building up the voice for the far west side so that we can better advocate for ourselves for those transportation connections that I want to see improved, as well as things like county mental health services. Because while I really appreciate the work that county health does with our trading partners who do the hands-on work in our community, I think that the fact that the isthmus needs a lot of services and the folks downtown need a lot of help, and we want to make sure that we're spreading that everywhere and that even folks as far out on the far west side like we are have the same access to care that everyone else does.
So you mentioned affordable housing earlier, but I'm curious, are there any other priorities for the county as a whole that you'd like to focus on? Any work you'd like to continue if reelected in April?
Another thing I'm very, very proud of is the work that the county has done as far as land conservation and setting aside and improving our public areas, especially coming to mind are the Indian Lake Park kind of expansion there, as well as the land purchases we've done around Sugar River. kind of just west of Paoli in southwestern Dane County. I think that that's going to have long-term pay huge dividends as far as preserving green space for residents, not just of my district, but of the whole county, as well as helping with, in general, flood mitigation, given the unpredictable nature of weather patterns these days, and making sure that we have that area set aside.
So I know that criminal justice reform is a big talking point this year. You know, this morning they broke ground on the new Dane County jail. What is your perspective on this issue?
So I've supported the jail project in the past because I absolutely believe that since we are statutorily required by the state to have a jail, that is our responsibility in Dane County to make sure we have the most humane, most up-to-date modern facility possible that focuses on treatment and focuses on getting folks who do not need to be in jail out of there and back, you know, with their families as quickly as reasonably possible, while making sure that we have a place where we can keep the folks who are the worst of the worst contained until it is time for a actual trial. And I think that we're doing our best to find that middle ground. Dane County has a long way to go as far as addressing racial disparities. I think that's one of those things that is frustrating, that we haven't seen more progress in the time I've been around. I would love to see more implementation of the criminal justice recommendations that the county board has made. And we're just kind of, we need to really get that, take that last step of getting some of these programs that we've supported in the past implemented.
Your opponent, John Walliger, told us yesterday that he wants the county to rethink its spending and reduce pressure on taxpayers. Do you have a response to that?
I appreciate that the county has held the line slightly better than some of our other local government units, but at the same time, I recognize that mostly due to bonding issues, we are pushing up a little bit higher than I would like to see. I think that we need to put county bonding and county projects on a bit of a diet. The interest on bonds is about 13% of our operating budget. I think that the county should, either through ordinance or just through its own agreement with itself, limit that to a maximum of 10% going forward. And that as part of that process, we should take a look at kind of how each individual unit of the county government is coming up with these bonding projects. One of the reasons it's gotten a little bit higher than I would like to see is because the board is forced to effectively, the best term for it is play whack-a-mole with these projects that we don't see coming long-term. I would like to see kind of a five-year capital improvement project plan done for each county department so that we can plan long-term for these, so that we can budget appropriately going forward, because I think that's one of the reasons that we end up in these situations. And I would also potentially like to see us at least have a conversation about where we can share purchasing power with other local municipalities and local units of government, and there's no reason that we shouldn't be focusing on savings there.
So, meanwhile, Dane County Executive Joe Parisi's retirement is around the corner. What are your thoughts on that race?
I've always been a fan of the county executive and have always worked very well with him and his staff in the past, and have no reason to believe that my perspective on that would change no matter who the new county executive would be. I think that while it's always important to, you know, make sure that we're providing checks and balances to one another, you know, we all have the best interest of Dane County at heart. It's important that we find someone who has a long-term experience, who understands Dane County and really wants to, you know, be a champion for its people. But I think beyond that, that's my focus.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
I feel that I am a strong representative for our community. I feel like I reflect the values and the perspectives of our district very well. I've been endorsed by our friends at AFSCME, as well as Planned Parenthood and Fair Wisconsin and South Central Federation of Labor. I reflect the values and kind of needs of the district. And we have a lot of young families and a lot of young folks who are just trying to get going in the ninth. And I think that it's important that we have folks who can understand that perspective.
Thank you again for agreeing to speak with me, Stephen.
Well, thank you.
That was incumbent supervisor Stephen Peters, one of two candidates vying for the District 9 seat, representing Madison's far west side on the Dane County Board. Peters says if he retains his seat, he will continue to protect the environment and advocate for the expansion of public transportation services. Yesterday, we heard from his opponent, John Walliger. You can access Walliger's interview on our website. Walliger and Peters will face off on April 2nd.
And you're listening to Handcrafted Local News here on WORT. Stay with us. A lot more coming at you in the second half of the show. We explore the connection between the arts and archives. We'll travel back in time to 1961. And we've had a little taste of the rains this evening. We'll be wetting up a lot more tomorrow. I'll give you all the details on that.
But first, we'll take a quick break, and then we'll check in on some world headlines. Back in a flash.
ABC News with Temeskin Devasai. China has warned that a potential ban on TikTok in the US would backfire on America. The House of Representatives passed a bill that could force the app's Chinese owners to either sell up or be barred in the country. Israel says it's investigating an attack on a United Nations food distribution center in Rafah City in Gaza. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says one of its staff was killed in an apparent Israeli airstrike. A court in Italy has refused to extradite a Palestinian suspect to Israel, saying he risks poor treatment there. Judges turned down an application after viewing reports by rights groups on prison conditions. The far-right Dutch politician Geert Wilders has failed in his bid to become the country's prime minister. His anti-migrant Freedom Party emerged as the biggest after elections in November, but coalition talks have repeatedly broken down. The United Nations says it's begun evacuating non-essential staff from Haiti because of the volatile security situation. It also says it will set up an air bridge from the Dominican Republic to deliver aid. Political leaders are negotiating the formation of a transition council after the Prime Minister resigned. European Union countries have agreed to provide Ukraine with an extra $5 million to buy weapons for its fight against Russia's invasion. Kyiv has warned that it's running out of arms. One man has died and 29 people have been rescued after a gold mine collapsed in the Australian state of Victoria. Two men were trapped hundreds of meters underground. One body was recovered, the other man was airlifted to hospital. The Australian trailblazing footballer Josh Cavallo has proposed to his boyfriend on the pitch at Adelaide United's Coopers Stadium. When he came out in 2021, he was the world's only top-flight openly gay male professional footballer.
The time is now 6:32, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure, here with my co-host, Vicki Iden. Thanks for staying with us.
This week on Framing Culture, feature contributor José Carlos Teixeira talks over the phone with Matthew Bacham. Bacham is a conceptual artist and researcher from Minneapolis with UW-Madison ties. Together, they'll discuss Bacham's ongoing research-based civic project. Bacham also shares some of the artistic concerns behind his own practice, anchored on the archive as a concept and a reality.
Framing Culture. Welcome to the sixth episode of Framing Culture. I am back after a five-week interval due to personal issues around health, but I'm glad to be back, and today I have a pleasure to be interviewing an artist and a friend. His name is
Matthew Bacham.
And I'm connecting directly from Madison, Wisconsin to Minneapolis, Minnesota. How are you doing?
Just fine. Thanks, Jose. Just got back from work and very pleased to speak with you.
So Matthew is a visual and conceptual artist, researcher, and educator who has spent some substantial time in Madison while teaching at UW-Madison. And I always remember undergrads and grads praising his inspirational classes and lectures. And so my first question would be, what are your fondest memories of working with students here?
There were so many moments with so many students. And as an educator, they don't get ranked into a place. They become part of your practice. It's hard to point one out. It was a real pleasure to work with so many lovely people in Madison. I'm just glad to hear people, that there's still some whisper that I was there, because it was a great time for me.
So Matthew, after 2017, he actually spent a period of time in his beloved New York City, and then he went back to Minneapolis, where he is now. So Matthew, I'm actually quite interested in having you letting us know about a project of yours called Collective Investigation, and it's a process that you have applied and perfected over the years and in different contexts, and right now at the public library there. Is that correct?
That's right, Jose. I've been working on the collective investigation, the method of collective investigation, since 1998, its point of inception. It's a very simple small group method for coming together and exploring collections of printed matter together, and through a simple series of steps, creating a script that we all kind of perform together that then also goes on as a two-dimensional object, a book of its own. The method itself is very simple. It takes about 2.5 hours. All you need is 5 to 10, 12 people and a collection of printed matter. Most lately, I've been working with the Minneapolis Public Library of the Hennepin County Library System to present a series at the library over the course of the last 7 or 8 months, but it's a year-long project, ideally, where I've been organizing these kinds of investigations in conference rooms on each distinct floor of the library, the third floor being arts and music and literature, fourth floor being social sciences and history, and now we're moving on to the second floor coming up in March and into April, which is science and technology. Going on, it's something that I shared in Madison within the context of my teaching, but I've been doing kind of throughout the United States and sometimes in Europe over the course of the last 25 years.
Yes, and that's why I was particularly interested in having you shed some light on that, because it's definitely one of the projects that you have been always engaged with. And I think that as time progresses, you also are probably finding new ways and new frames within this process. So right now, it's actually fascinating to hear you are exploring the different levels. And by the way, for those who don't know, the Minneapolis Public Library is a beautiful, great building by Pelly Architects. I was there last year while visiting Matthew, and I had the pleasure to just immerse myself, as I love doing it, in libraries. And it's definitely a special, wonderful space. So let me ask you, is the space in itself also somehow conducive or nourishing the process itself of the collective investigation?
It's my feeling that any library, regardless of size, is nourishing in some essential way. In this one, it's a fairly monumental library by civic standards in the United States. And, you know, it was ideally somehow designed for this kind of thing. Certainly in terms of the creation of spaces in which people can gather in combination with remarkable collections of printed material, including picture collections and all kinds of fantastic objects that a library maintains on a regular basis. So I think this particular location for me is special, as it's also the first library in which I was kind of operating as a teenager, learning about the city, learning about libraries, learning about a lot of things. In this particular case, it's not the same building. The building that I grew up with was demolished and then replaced by the building that currently exists. A process that at the time I was not thrilled about, but now I see it's what we have, and it's very much of the moment. I mean, the library space of, especially civic library spaces of 2024, strangely contested spaces in that they offer their staff and their collections and their structure offer so much to people, but some of the dynamics, both inside of shared public space as a general concern, specifically, to be honest, for our unhoused populations who find the library to be a place that they're welcome and they can participate in on whatever level is their choosing. It's a very free and open space. Of course, this creates a certain kind of tension with people who don't have perhaps a certain level of sympathy with unhoused people or experience with unhoused people.
Exactly. And I can only imagine that, as you say, that creates a specific dynamics. On one hand, all embracing, on the other, challenging for the use of these commons of the public space.
And the reality, a very important reality, is that something like collective investigation can bring participants to the space. And they can experience it, and they can see that indeed it's a very functional space. And you may be discovering things that are new to you, but they are not threatening. They are not something that should discourage you from participating in this very particular commons of the library space. On the other hand, there's a challenge within the notion of the library itself, which is certainly accelerated by the transition to digital sharing. There was a time in which, only not so long ago, that the way things were shared, where they were created through analog methods and analog distribution methods. That's what mostly is in the library. But the library is also a great digital resource. The libraries in general have been participating in the creation of this kind of digital world they are very important parts of it now. But how do you get people to this? That doesn't bring people to the structure and to the commons and to the shared space and timing and the physical aspect of knowledge. You know, browsing is a very romantic thing. You're moving your body through time and space in search of something. It's an object that you can't comprehend by a click. You have to comprehend by a grasp.
That's why I find the process intriguing and fascinating, because it sort of rescues that bodily awareness that so many, probably from younger generations, have never felt, because they are just engaged with the digital dimension from their laptops. I just would like now, in the last couple of minutes, Matthew, to, let's say, swim and dive from the library as this deep and wonderful space of the archive into your own practice, in which for so many years you have dealt with archives. So tell us a little bit, what have you been doing in terms of your art experimentations and new projects, in which I know that you are still examining archives and photos and prints and sculpture making?
I find myself at this point in my career, you know, having kind of begun serious engagement in the early 1990s as both a presenter but also a maker of things. I find myself now having a kind of a dual course, one running in a studio model, which is a place where I negotiate in private with the material that I've accumulated, whether it's my own personal photographic archives or material that I've inherited from various sources. On my studio side, I try to work with this kind of world. I've had a lot of experience working with the quote-unquote archives of the outside. So the archive of the self is happening in the studio. Working with the public space and trying to find an even more dynamic and ultimately, ideally positive way to contribute my practice is the other channel. It's a two channels. I have in this space of the public interaction, it's important to me to balance these things. They're like two wheels on a bike. Mm-hmm. One drives the other in a way that I don't really understand, but they're both on the same bike, which is my practice. So artistically, this becomes the way to understand how you operate. In my case, it happens to be these two interlinked systems, but they're all grounded in a larger self project, of course. But these are the artistic specifications of the bike, so to speak.
Last time I visited you, I remember looking at these beautiful new prints that you have with some archival images, and I thought, wow, what an amazing new body of work. Thank you so much for your participation in Framing Culture, and I send you a hug to Minneapolis.
Hugs, hugs, hugs back to you and back to Madison. I do miss it, and I'm so pleased that this interview is going to be broadcast from WORT. I was a big fan when I was there. I really wish the best to the station and all the volunteers.
Thank you, Matthew.
Ciao.
And it's time now for the most comprehensive weather report on the airwaves with WORT weather guru, Rob McClure.
Well, one more spectacular day, at least until the rain started up. We've been averaging 16.3 degrees above normal since the start of this work week. We haven't set any high temperature records during that time, though we came within a couple of degrees on Monday. Yesterday's 68-degree high definitely outperformed expectations, or at least my expectations, but fell still a good bit short of the 75-degree record. And today's 65 likewise fell several degrees short of the 71-degree record set back in 1995. Still, though, very, very warm for March, needless to say, much like the most of the month has been so far. We're running 13 degrees above normal through the first 2 weeks, or near 2 weeks. So that's 2-plus degrees warmer still, even than February, which was also, of course, quite warm. Actually, if this month were April instead of March even, we'd still be 1.5 degrees above normal. We are going to be cooling off over the coming days and wetting up as well in the fashion kind of similar to what happened last weekend, though the rains are going to occur tomorrow rather than Friday this week. And the cool-off will be longer and somewhat stronger than last week, lasting, well, through the weekend and out into about Tuesday, the way it's looking. I think this will finally give us our first below-normal temperature days for March. That might be on Sunday and Monday. Have a look at the water vapor image of the continental U.S. that we have linked on the WORT weather webpage this evening, and you'll see a fairly vigorous upper trough pushing ashore over the west coast the past day or two, which is now in a position with its pit over about northern Arizona to translate the speed maximum that's currently diving through it into falling surface pressures out on the plains just to its northeast, which you can see in the closed rings of isobars on that image starting to develop over the North Texas Panhandle. The surface circulation will propagate northeastward to around northwestern Missouri by tomorrow morning, lifting a warm front into northern Illinois out ahead of it, over which moisture is going to be lifted to produce precipitation here into the south. The overnight and early morning scenario is a little bit complicated, in part because of a dry wedge of low-level air that pushed south into the area over this past day and may still retard the onset of precipitation in areas around Madison and north, and also in part due to uncertainty about the strength and evolution of convection down to our south across Illinois later tonight and into tomorrow morning. There is some indication on some of the high-resolution modeling that stronger and deeper development down there to our south may intercept some of the initial moisture return on the front end of this storm as well. As we get into the day, though, tomorrow, it looks fairly certain we'll see some extended periods of what will be cold rain generated along the elevated frontal surface that will be up above us, which will be driven on stiff northeasterly winds as low pressure passes to our south through the afternoon. Rains will knock off in the late day hours, and with clearing overnight, I think that should allow temperatures to return to about 50 or so on Friday, given sunshine. But a stronger cold front will be lining up to our north for Saturday morning, likely without precipitation during its passage, but with thickening cloud cover Saturday, so temperatures may actually start descending after noon and through the afternoon Saturday. We'll see temperatures confined then to the upper 30s for a couple of days there, Sunday and Monday. That'd be a handful of degrees colder than normal anyway. But we'll rewarm again by the time Tuesday and Wednesday roll around before another possible cool-off late week, still to be determined how that's going to play out. But back to tonight, this first round of warm air advection showers over these past couple of hours are due to incoming moisture up above it about 8,000 feet or so. That moisture is not particularly deep to view it on the visible satellite image, and the rains have been very light. At the moment, the indications are that precipitation will continue to travel off mostly to the northeast of Madison with the mid-level winds. I have seen some backbuilding in the past half hour or so around Madison and parts northwest and southeast. Passing sprinkles or showers therefore remain possible going forward, but they will become more likely, I think, after a dry period in the evening, more prevalent from south to north as we get on past midnight and on towards tomorrow morning. Temperatures will drop back to the mid-40s on easterly winds at 5 to 10 miles per hour, backing more northeasterly and increasing as we get on towards dawn. And tomorrow will be showery and cool, with northeasterly winds increasing to 12 to 20 miles per hour through the course of the day. I think convection will hold south of us by and large. The southern parts of the listing area in particular may get in on an occasional passing elevated thunderstorm. And a rumble of thunder is possible also in Madison. Temperatures will hold in the mid-40s through much of the day, dropping off then to the low 30s overnight as we clear and winds back more northerly at 8 to 12 miles per hour. And Friday will be a little bit brisk, but fairly nice. Sunny and up around 50 with northerly winds backing more northwesterly at 8 to 12 miles per hour. And the winds will continue to back west and southwest through that ensuing overnight, and cloud cover will swing southeastward into the area from Minnesota sometime around dawn on Saturday ahead of the incoming cold front. And that front will increase winds steadily after sometime in the earlier mid-morning period and start veering winds back more westerly and northwesterly, coming up to 15 to 25 miles per hour through the course of the day. The cloud deck that comes in may break up as we go through the day, at least to some extent, but temperatures will, I think, descend out of the low 50s in the late morning into the 40s as we get on towards evening and drop towards 30 then overnight, with northwesterly winds remaining up in the 10 to 15 miles per hour range overnight. And Sunday will be cold and a little bit breezy still, with temperatures stuck in the upper 30s, with northwesterly winds again increasing to about 12 to 18 miles per hour. At the moment at the station down here on Bedford Street, the temperature is 57 degrees still. The dew point has come up markedly over the past hour, up to 42 degrees now. Winds are out of the northeast at 9 miles per hour. Sprinkles, a few of them coming down when I poked my head out of the station about 5 minutes ago or 10 minutes ago, falling out of a 9,000-foot ceiling with some passing clouds below it. And the barometer is at 29.85 inches of mercury and holding steady over the past few hours.
We go now to March 1961. For bad news for Frank Lloyd Wright's Monona Terrace, evidence of racism and anti-Semitism, and more. Stu Levitan has the headlines from 63 years ago this month on tonight's Madison in the 60s. All these come by. They melt in. To a
dream. Madison in the 60s, March 1961. The spring primary on the 7th brings double-barreled bad news for Frank Lloyd Wright's Monona Terrace Auditorium and Exhibition Hall. In the morning, construction bids are open for the ambitious project, which the city approved in 1954, but which opponents have delayed since then through litigation and legislation. And it's quickly evident that their plan to kill the project through economic pressures was a good one, as more than 6 years of inflation knocked the budget completely out of whack. In November 1954, city voters approved $4 million in bonds for the project, which the world-famous architect said would marry the city and the lake. The city parking utility later added $1.5 million, for a total budget of $5.5 million, and the project finally went out to bid earlier this year. But when bids are opened, the cost is a staggering $13 million. It doesn't help that there's only one bidder. The Perini Corporation of Boston, Massachusetts, owned by the principal owner of the Milwaukee Braves. Perini's most recent Madison job was the City County building in 1957, which Wright publicly disdained as, quote, a nice cereal box. It's a devastating blow to Monona Terrace and to the political hopes of mayoral candidate Bob Knuckles, running on a platform of finishing the project started by his former boss, former mayor Ivan Nestegan. And it's a tremendous boon to Knuckles' opponent, businessman and former alder Henry Reynolds, running on a platform of finishing the project off. Reynolds, president of his family's moving and storage company, is already in good shape. When primary votes are tallied that night, he leads the field of five with 47% of the vote. Knuckles in second place, more than 3,000 votes behind. Reynolds pounces. The people who promoted this unwise and ill-planned project should be ashamed of what they have done, he says. Monona Terrace is now on life support and could not survive a Reynolds victory in the April election. One project that definitely won't be going forward, a proposal for 120 units of affordable housing in the Burr Oaks plat off South Park Street. The housing, to be built with union funds and federal loan guarantees, would provide about 50 units for low-income families and the elderly, and the rest for union members. But the Madison Redevelopment Authority, the city's urban renewal agency, kills the plan because it believes the development would likely create the kind of slums it is trying to eliminate. In other housing news, nursing homes in Dane County don't accept black or Jewish patients, a member of the county public assistance department charges, even though they complain about vacancies. Mrs. Viola Waters tells the county board's hospital study committee that 21 of the county's 33 nursing homes have submitted signed statements declaring they will only accept white patients, and the others follow that practice informally as well. And while none of the homes indicated they had religious restrictions, Waters tells the committee that many won't accept Jews either. Representatives of the Dane County Nursing Home Association had previously assured the committee they had no racial or religious restrictions. Jews and blacks also come in for special focus on campus, as the Daily Cardinal publishes a front-page story exploring the attitudes of in-state students toward their non-resident classmates. According to one Racine senior, quote, "The reason why many New Yorkers, who seem to be mostly Jewish and Negroes, come here is the liberal attitude." He cites the Socialist Club as an example that, quote, "they get away with things here they couldn't get away with anywhere else." A Madison sophomore says they're also a bit stuck up. "A large population of the New Yorkers are from one religious background and stick by themselves," the student says. "The fact that they are from New York makes them feel that they are too good." But out-of-state students are not feeling too good about their housing situation, especially the non-resident co-eds, who are sent scrambling after the university announces a new policy that no more than 6% of the students living in residence halls can be from out-of-state. And a Republican legislator doesn't have much use for non-resident students either, especially the ones who come to a state assembly hearing to oppose the resolution praising the controversial House Committee on Un-American Activities. "When it comes to considering the opinions of the people of the state," Representative Niles Soik of Whitefish Bay says, "we want the legislature to know that student opposition to this proposal does not accurately reflect the opinion of the students." According to investigation by the state Republican Party, 46 of the 58 students who registered in opposition to the resolution praising HUAC were from out of state, 40 of them from New York. Even Democratic Governor Gaylord Nelson is under fire for speaking ill of HUAC, including from members of his own party, as three of the four Democrats on the Assembly Judiciary Committee join all seven Republicans in voting to censure Nelson for saying HUAC should be abolished. One of the Democrats reveals political cowardice is why he endorsed the censure resolution. "I'm going to be branded a communist if I vote against this," says Representative William Ward of New Richmond. And also on campus, beloved English professor Helen C. White is announced as the guest speaker for the Union Forum Committee's last lecture series, which lets distinguished faculty speak as though it were their last time in a classroom. Known around campus for her purple attire, Professor White is a two-time chair of the English department, recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship and numerous honorary degrees, and was the first female president of the American Association of University Professors. A staunch foe of anti-communist demagogue Senator Joseph McCarthy, White gave the main address at the rededication of the famed Sifting and Winnowing plaque in Bascom Hall in 1957. And that's this week's Madison in the 60s. For your award-winning, listener-supported, pledge-appreciating WORT News Team, I'm Stu Levitan.
And that does it for our show. Thanks for listening to WORT's live local news at 6. And thanks to all of you out there who did support it the past couple of weeks during our pledge drive. You keep this news non-commercial and free from commercial influence. Your headline writer this evening was Greg Sanderson. Your reporter was David Aaron. Special thanks to our feature contributors, Jose Carlos Texiera and Stu Levitan. Katie Giorgella engineered tonight's broadcast and Faye Parks produced it. Shelley Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure.
And I'm your host, Vicki Iden. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is Query, followed by This Way Out. Good night. WORT would like to thank the following local restaurants and businesses who provided meals for our hardworking volunteers during our recent winter pledge drive. Bandung, Bonzo, Cardinal Bar, Cooper's Tavern, Einstein's Coffee and Bagels, Glass Nickel Pizza West, Hong Kong Cafe, Ian's Pizza on State Street and Francis Street, Just Veggies, Lao Lang Zong, Migrants Madison, Melio's on MLK, Original Pancake House on University Ave, Pizza Bruta,
Soup's I Did It Again in Spring Green, Teddy Wedgers, Weary Traveler Free House, Wilma's Fund LGBT Assistance, and the Willie Street Co-op. WORT would like to extend our gratitude to these restaurants for helping to put the community in WORT Community Radio through their donations of food. Gratefully yours for nearly five decades, this is WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
You wake up to the 8 o'clock buzz to get the week started.
Now, we need the help of a good volunteer to run our on-air operations each Monday.
Sure, that means waking up a little earlier.
To get to the station around 7:30.
But that's why WORT has coffee.
So that you can start your week off right.
WORT is recruiting a volunteer to run the soundboard each week on Monday mornings from 7:30 to 9 a.m.
You'd run all on-air operations for our morning program, The 8 O'Clock Buzz with Brian Standing.
No experience is necessary, but a familiarity with computers and a strong sense of punctuality and reliability are preferred.
For details, call 608-256-2001 and ask to speak with Shali Pittman.
Or head online to WORTFM.org/volunteer to fill out our volunteer application.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Bluestem Jazz, presenting Jessica Ackerley with Tim Daisy and Josh Berman on Saturday, March 23rd, 8 p.m. at Audio for the Arts. Jessica Ackerley is a Canadian guitarist, improviser, and composer based in Honolulu. Ackerley draws on the influences of Black American music and avant-garde improvisers, as well as the culture of the thriving New York City rock and noise scenes. More information and tickets are available at bluestemjazz.org.
The following program is syndicated. Please excuse any dated references. You're listening to WORT Madison.
Welcome to Out in